Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.
I had this huge cloud of material with lightning and blue and purple colors, rumbling to lightning hitting the ground. I had to get away from that.
Dave starts walking uphill, through the steaming mud, through the ash cloud. He turns on the camera and starts to talk.
Well, dear God, whoever finds this, I don't know. You can't see this, I'm sure it's too dark. I've left the car behind. First to the gear, we got one magazine. And as you can tell probably from this picture, I'm walking towards the only light I can see on top of a ridge. I can hear the mountain behind me rumbling. It's an enormous mud and water slide came down and washed out the road. I never really thought I'd believe this or say this, but at this moment, I honest to God believe I'm dead. There's really no way to describe those feelings. I feel the ash now in my eyes. It's getting very hard to breathe. Burns to breathe. I'm having trouble talking. Burns to breathe. Burns my eyes. Oh, dear God. My God, this is hell. I just can't describe it. It's pitch black. Just pitch black. This is hell on earth I'm walking through.
Featuring Joe Sweeney from Thinking Sideways Podcast and filmmaker Vincent Caldoni. This is The Shocking Details.
Hey there. Welcome to another episode of The Shocking Details. I'm Joe, joined as always by
Vincent Caldoni.
And that interesting little clip you just heard, Vincent is the one who found that, and I'm going to let him explain what you just listened.
So the audio you heard just now before we started was a guy, I mean, he's really a kid at the time. His name's Dave Crockett, and it's May 18th, 1980, when that audio was
May recorded. 18th, that's a familiar day, at least just, here in the Northwest.
Yeah, especially people of a certain age around here know that day. Dave drove to Mount St. Helens, hoping to grab some pictures and footage of the mountain as it was about to erupt. And he succeeded in that.
Oh, wildly.
Then he succeeded in getting some pictures and film of it as it became the largest volcanic eruption in the history of the continental United States and the deadliest in the history of the U.S.
You know, actually, he's incredibly lucky to be alive.
I think if you go and you can go find that footage, it's not hard to find. You're Dave Crockett, Mount St. Helens, like whatever, and see it. It's more terrifying.
Yeah. It's scary to watch.
Because he was rolling video or I think 16 millimeter film at the time. And you see what he's seeing and how dark it is and how hard it is for him to find his way. It's absolutely more harrowing than just the audio.
Yeah. If I had been him, because he talks, he mentions that I wonder if I feel like maybe I'm already dead.
Yeah.
And that's what I was thinking when I was watching this. I'd be wondering too. I'd be thinking, wow, is the devil is showing me like a trailer of, you know, a little preview of what to expect in hell.
Well, yeah. And when you see it, it looks like some weird Hollywood vision of a, maybe not hell, but like the afterlife, some limbo or something.
Yeah. And it's very alien too. You can picture them like, you know, this is an alien planet that you're on.
Great. But yeah, it does look like he's on another world where they have like this dense cloud cover or something. So the hellscape though, this nightmarescape that Dave's wandering through, it actually was once a majestic and beautiful wilderness that got turned into this end times nightmare by this massive cloud of volcanic ash and vaporized rock and glacier.
Yeah, it was tough times, especially the first eruption was, there were two eruptions, major eruptions actually, but the first one, luckily for us here in the Portland metro area, the wind was blowing the other way. Mm-hmm. And so the guys over in Eastern Washington caught the brunt of it, and there was a lot of crap that came down. And then there was a second smaller eruption about a month later in June, and the wind was blowing the other direction. So we got it here in Portland. I was over at a little get together at a friend's apartment. And when we left, we went outside. It was a warm June night and it was snowing.
Yeah.
Believe it or not, it was sort of lightly gray instead of bright white flecks, but it was snowing ash. And we didn't realize that the mountain had blown up again. But of course, when we saw that it was snowing ash, we realized what had happened. Mm-hmm. But it was so weird. I mean, it was driving down the road to a friggin' snowstorm.
Yeah, in the middle of June.
On a warm June night. It was really surreal.
Yeah.
And then we had to deal with that stuff for like, oh God, that the ash lingered for literally like a couple of years. We were dealing with that stuff.
Yeah. So what I've heard about it, this is like right around the time I was born. So, I was not born when it erupted. I was born shortly after. But what I've heard from people is that, you know, everyone thought, oh, all this ash is on the ground and a good rain will wash it away. But it didn't. It turned it into like cement and it just got stuck to stuff.
It did. And it was everywhere. And it like you go to clean your gutters on your roof, you know, and it's just jam packed with that stuff. And if it dried out, it was hard.
Yep.
Yeah. And and it was just everywhere. But anyway, it's all kind of gone now. It's not really gone. It's just down there buried in the soil somewhere.
It's probably why like my plumbing's all slow.
Yeah. I mean, that was a joy of the eruption of Mount St. Helens.
Yeah. If you're listening to this and you are like, what is Mount St. Helens? I don't know much about this or I've never heard of it. I think most people have. Unfortunately, we're not going to dwell too much on that. We're not going to delve too much deeper into it, but you really should look it up. There's incredible footage. It was a massive and catastrophic event. I think 60 people lost their lives that first day, something like that. It's really worth investigating on your own time.
Oh, yeah. And it was a damn shame, too, because the original Mount St. Helens was a beautiful mountain.
There is, Joe, I just want to toss this in. I never went up there before the eruption because I wasn't born. There is not a soul I've spoken to who went up there prior to the eruption who doesn't say exactly what you just said.
Yeah, it was beautiful. It was. I mean, you could see it from Portland. I mean, I lived in an apartment and I could see it out my kitchen window, and it was just a beautiful mountain. And then one day I got up. I'd been out partying the night before. The day happened to be May 18th, 1980. And I looked out the window. I was getting some water to make some coffee. And I thought, holy crap. Because there was this massive column of smoke and ash from the mountain stretching all. It was miles wide and stretching all the way up to the stratosphere.
Oh, my God. Mean,
holy crap.
Yeah. I mean, it would have been insane.
Like, yeah. It was like, whoa. And but anyway, it is a crying shame that the mountain is gone. It's still cool. I mean, it's still
amazing up there.
It's still a cool mountain. I mean, just it's not as beautiful as it used to be. Definitely not as tall as it used to be.
So my father grew up hunting and fishing on Mount St. Helens, and then in his youth, his 20s, he logged on Mount St. Helens, and he'll go on and on about just how beautiful it was and how many fish there were up there. But we're not talking about Mount St. Helens in general.
We're talking about a specific creepy area near Mount St. Helens.
It's actually a pretty small part of the mountain.
Yeah, it's on the southern slopes, kind of. Yeah,
but it has a lot of weird history. We're talking about Ape Canyon.
Yeah.
This is a place shrouded in beauty, mystery, and, of course, disaster. So let's just start off by giving the story of how this mighty stratovolcano came into existence?
Started, I think, with volcanic activity. There is a an old legend from the Indian tribes. I think the Puyallup tribe has one specific legend in it. I'm not going to go into the details of it, but essentially there was a lady who was granted immortality, and she lived on the Columbia River near Cascade Locks, and then she was granted immortality and timeless beauty. But then these two brothers came, one from the north and one from the south, and began to battle over her affections. And then their father comes along and sees what's going on, loses it, and just unleashes hellfire on the entire region and turns them into mountains. So the beautiful woman becomes Mount St. Helens.
Or Lewitt.
Yeah. And then one of the, I think it was Y East, one of the sons becomes Mount Hood in Oregon. And then the other son becomes Mount Adams.
Yeah.
So that was the Indian legend. And backed up by science, of course. And we all believe in science, right? You're not against science, are you? So there you go.
Okay, wait. You're being funny, but I do just want to point out that this lore was seen as really strange to white settlers when they first came here. But the story seems to contain some amount of lore that would explain or advise the volcanic activity in the area, which is something that people really didn't think was, they thought it was all in the past. They didn't think it was something they'd ever have to contend with. And not everybody, but a lot of people thought this right up until late 1979, when Lewitt, that's the native name for the Puyallup name for Mount St. Helens, reared its pretty head again.
Rumbling. Yeah, no, I remember that. I mean, because we all thought it was a perfectly solid, stable mountain that would be there forever. And then it started seeing tremors and stuff. And then this big fissure opens up in the side of the mountain and smoke starts coming out.
Yeah.
And I say it was a big fissure because you could see it with the naked eye from downtown Portland.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was a pretty big honking fissure. And it kept getting bigger and bigger, you know, and
am I wrong to say, like, because I wasn't alive in this time, that must have been terrifying, right? To just be like on your way to work and look up and be like, the fissure got bigger. I wonder if I'm okay. Or was it just another thing?
It wasn't terrifying to anybody here because we're miles and miles away from the mountain. We could see it loud. We could see it totally clearly.
We're not that far, but
we're far enough away that nobody was panicking over it or anything like that.
Okay. Not at all.
But we figured that it could have some consequences for us, and it did, but nothing, you know, any worse than what we thought it would.
Okay.
You know, the one to really watch for that's going to be cataclysmic is when Mount Rainier goes. That's going to take out Tacoma.
It's going to take out Tacoma. It's going to take out Seattle. It could be.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it's going to be interesting.
Olympia's probably on that list. Portland and Vancouver are not going to look great.
Yeah. No, it's. And don't even get me started on Yellowstone. You know, but
well, we're all done when that one goes. Just drink up whatever's in your fridge, take a nap, and forget about it because there's nothing you can do when that one goes off.
No, go max out your credit cards. You know, go shoot your neighbors that you don't like. Have some fun.
Yeah, they don't make. You can look up the mega volcano at the heart of North America. And trust me, they don't make a shelter that's going to get you through that one.
No, but anyway, enough of this talk about this. But so there was some cataclysmic stuff. And of course, let's not forget, we also have Crater Lake here, which was kind of like Mount St. Helens in a sense. It's way, way back deep in time when it went. Not that long ago,
I believe Crater Lake. When did Crater Lake go off?
I can't remember. I mean, it wasn't like thousands of years ago.
No, that's what I'm saying. It was 500-600 years ago, if I recall.
Yeah, a long time ago. But anyway, but it blew. It was considerate enough to kind of, instead of blowing off to one side the way Mount St. Helens did, it sort of blew straight up, making this nice caldera that filled up with water and making this incredibly beautiful lake. So it's kind of cool.
The clearest lake in North America.
Yeah, it's an amazingly cool lake.
It's amazing.
Beautiful
place. If you get the chance to go out on it.
Yeah.
After these mountains were formed with all this anger and heartbreak, ancient spirits, the volcanic soil around what the white settlers would call Lewitt, Mount St. Helens, would yield a wilderness of immense beauty, easy game hunting, abundant foraging. A lot of it, I think, comes into the volcanic soil.
And it's still, by the way, it still is a beautiful place. I mean, it's recovered from the quite mostly from the eruption, and forests and streams have gotten better.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. People have learned a lot about how fast nature can recover from a major volcanic eruption.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When I was little, they were predicting it would still be a sort of almost nuclear looking wasteland at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And it really isn't. It's in large ways, it's recovering. It's less dramatic to go up there now than when I was a kid.
Yeah,
and I think it shows that nature evolved to rebound from these volcanic eruptions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, nature does. Plants can just pop up and cover all kinds of damage. But one of the things we didn't really get a lot of formation of these little craters this time around. But in the past, way back in the misty past, when we had lava flows, we got these cool things out of it called lava tubes.
Yeah,
lots of them. Yeah. There's a bunch of them up there. I've been through a few of them. I think you have too.
So if you don't know what a lava tube is, it's a cave, but it may be a little different from other caves you've been in. If you haven't been around a lot of volcanoes or areas that had once had volcanic activity, at least, they tend to be reasonably straight and they're like tunnels. They almost look like mines. Mm. And some of them can be quite small. Some of them can be so small you can't stand up in them.
Some of them are enormous.
Exactly. They can be huge.
Yeah.
They usually were packed full of different kind of debris, whether that's plant matter or just dirt or sometimes ice or sometimes just pockets of gas. And they form, and then whatever's inside them, whether regardless of what it is through some method either, you know, decomposes or is taken away. And now you get this amazing tunnel, which sometimes can network with these other tunnels. Yeah. Well, just look up ape caves in Washington. They're incredible.
Yeah, no, it is cool. And, I gotta say, the first time I ever went through Ape Cave, I went through the lower part, and there's parts of it, it's not straight as an arrow. It curves. It curves around side and gently curves and stuff. And that was not too terribly long after the original Alien came out.
Yeah.
And it reminded me very much of that enormous alien spaceship from the beginning of the movie.
Definitely. Yeah.
It reminds has that me feeling. A lot of that. It gave it a little extra creepiness. I liked it a lot. It's a really awesome laboratory, but they're different from, like, especially if you live toward in the east, the caves back there are limestone.
Right.
And they are formed through just erosion, essentially water interacts with the limestone and, you know, and it sort of erodes it away from the inside. And you get these beautiful limestone caves with stalactites and stalagmites. And these are formed in a completely different way.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That's why I was saying, like, they almost feel man-made because the tunnels are reasonably straight and you don't see those things you see in a cartoon depiction of a cave.
Yeah, no, I mean, limestone caves tend to be more of a maze type. You can get lost in those. It's kind of hard to get lost in a lava tube.
No, it depends. I've been in lava tubes that have weird side caverns and interconnections networks.
Sometimes, but not typically. I mean, not typically.
Ape Cave, you'd have to be a fool to get lost in Ape Cave.
You have to be spectacularly incompetent to get lost in there.
Because there's really only two ways you can go, and they both lead to the exit. I guess there's three ways you can go. Two of them lead to the exit. One leads to a dead end, and then the only way out is toward the exit. So you'd...
Yeah. Well, you could wind up going around in circles without realizing it if you were, again, really an idiot. But anyway, there's other scary stuff up there besides lava tubes. Bears, there's cougars.
There's all kinds of deadly wildlife. This place, this area around Mount St. Helens, we really was held in like basically a religious regard by the tribes that lived up there. But they also knew it was a place of some pretty great danger. As well as the frequent rock slides.
Avalanches. Yeah.
Yep. They can happen up there.
Yeah. And let's not forget the most famous scary dude that lives up there.
Sasquatch and his family.
Yeah. Yeah, Sasquatch goes by other names as well, of course. We call them Sasquatch, mostly Bigfoot. And the Indians up there have actually many names for this creature. There's a lot of Indian legends surrounding the Sasquatch. And they were the ape men of the Northwest. And when the white man showed up, of course, the Indians told them all these tales. Of course, you know, I've always sort of wondered when the white man shows up and the Indians tell them these stories, if the Indians aren't having a little fun with the white man. But you never know. I mean, they could be totally telling these stories, I mean, straight up, you know, with all seriousness, or they could be pulling their leg.
Well, I think it could be somewhere in the middle, Joe, but I would definitely say that we have evidence of myth-making rituals, ritual masks. That are still preserved in museums in British Columbia that show that this was a big part of their religious tradition in the area. Mm-hmm. So they may have been trying to freak the white man out from, you know, putting too big a foothold in the territory with stories of Sasquatch. For all intents and purposes, they did at least at some integral level believe in this.
Yeah. And word, of course, got back to entertainers like, say, P.T. Barnum, who put out a bounty. on Mr. Bigfoot. He put up a big reward for a live specimen of Bigfoot.
Oh, he was hoping for a long time he could get one of those.
Unfortunately, he never got one.
There are great stories of that are almost certainly falsified about men who claim to have caged one, but lost it trying to bring it back east. But I don't put a lot of stock in those stories.
I don't think Bigfoot is actually out to get us, you know, but I think if you actually like threw a net over one, his attitude might change a little bit.
I got a feeling he'd be pretty unhappy with you.
Yeah, you probably wouldn't live to tell the tale.
The oldest written account that we have is from 1865, an ethnographer named George Gibbs. He really became the first white man to actually sit down with pen and paper and transcribe the tales of Sasquatch. I don't want to turn this all into just a big Bigfoot episode, because I really could just make it all about it. But I do just want to talk real quick about how pre-contact lore differs from what your modern concept of Sasquatch might be.
I did some research on Sasquatch, eons ago when I was in college, a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And yeah, there are a lot of different descriptions of, they could almost have been describing entirely different creatures.
That's true. And that's really true. The variation is pretty great. If I were to pick up on some general themes, and it's tough to generalize because, like you said, the descriptions really vary, and his behavior story to story seems to vary quite a bit. But they didn't really talk about him and his family or his tribe as being an animal. They tend to see him more as a hirsute or very hairy man. Not as another animal, the way they would talk about a bear or something.
Yeah, just kind of an offshoot of the human race, maybe.
Yeah, I've seen language that gets translated calling Sasquatch a cousin, or sometimes just literally just as men. The Sasquatch is men, and he is described as having a family with like sons and daughters and things like that, in ways that sound very human. Mm-hmm. Mostly, what it seems is that Sasquatch, he could be a trickster. He could joke around. He would steal from people. He would play practical jokes. But the main thing was he was into his solitude and his seclusion. He really did not want to be around the Native Americans. Mm-hmm. So the most frightening thing that you would hear about him is that if you trespassed on his land, he'd defend his territory in this very specific way. Sasquatch would lob giant boulders from high places down onto unwanted visitors.
Ooh, ouch. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, sounds like, this is just pure speculation on my part, but what if there was an offshoot of the human race, a separate, that actually did exist, a really large, hairier human being, and he actually, say, came along with or immediately before or after the Native Americans when they crossed the land bridge into North America? Mm-hmm. You know, and it was here, maybe it was here already when they showed up. And, that's something like that is intriguing, and we'll never know. I doubt it, because we would have found some sort of evidence in Asia and Siberia, et cetera. So it's an intriguing possibility.
We could just spend the rest of the episode going back and forth.
And of course, we're here to talk about scary stories and mysteries, and so we can't really go on for much longer anyway.
No, but I will just say I am very open to that possibility. When we covered the Nimerigar, we talked about this, right? We don't have a complete fossil record of what hominins were living in North America, were living in East Asia at the time. We're still trying to figure out exactly when human beings came to North America. That number just keeps getting pushed back every time they find some new evidence. So I'll come off my rant about that.
I know. And actually we're still not 100% sure that they all came across via that land bridge.
There's starting to be good evidence that there were different methods.
That people came here from different directions at different times. Who the hell knows? But anyway, that's not what we're here for. We're here to talk about creepy, shocking stuff.
We are. Let's talk about, can you tell us about 1924?
Well, that was 1924. This is a weird little story that happened. This the local paper here, the Oregonian, which is still around.
Hanging in there.
Yeah. They carried a story which reported a harrowing tale of a group of miners who were prospecting in Ape Canyon.
And wasn't called that back then.
No, but but one night they woke up and they heard these crashing noises of rocks raining down onto their cabin from above, which must have been kind of a jolt. But
not a great way to wake up.
They run from the cabin to see what the cause was. I'm not sure if that was a bright move or not. If there's rocks raining from the sky, you want to run outside? I'm not sure.
It was probably a tin roof, though, Joe.
Yeah.
It probably wasn't a lot of protection.
Yeah, they probably figured there was going to, maybe it was going to come down on their heads. And it was a fairly crudely constructed cabin, from what I understand.
Yeah, I don't think it was much.
But apparently somewhere far above their cabin, these giant ape-like creatures were lobbing boulders at them from some ridge or clifftop high above. So apparently it was out of rifle range, and all they could do was sort of like fire in that general direction and yell at them and try to scare them off. But the apes, the giant apes, were not scared off. They were fearless and just continued. And now they were howling and screaming ferociously at the miners until the miners were basically forced to retreat. Their cabin, of course, was ruined.
And came back the next morning and found it just totally destroyed.
Yeah, of course, eventually they made their way back to civilization and told their tale. Now, that sounds a little bit incredible to me.
It's a really incredible story. I mean,
yeah, that was sort of the beginning of the obsession with the mysterious ape man of the forests of the Northwest.
Yeah, you will find little stories where white folks talk about, you know, the ape men, the brush ape, they call it. But you don't hear much about it until this 1924 incident. Now, but what I will say for the 1924 incident is that I don't know how much these local miners knew about native lore, but it tracks pretty good. Throwing boulders from a high place when you get too far up the mountain and into Susquehanna's fits really good.
It does. You know, of course, again, you don't know what these guys knew. More likely than not, they knew nothing about it. But
that would seem likely.
Maybe they knew all about it.
Right.
You know, I don't know.
Yeah, it is possible. So the local tribes, they actually came forward as this started to be a bigger news story, and they wanted to share their collected lore on Susquehanna's, or the Zyatko tribe, which is what they were sometimes known as, I believe, in Puyallup. Sorry if I got that wrong. Send me an email, correct me. But yeah, the Zyatko tribe was what they referred to the ape men. And also, to somewhat contradict your story, Joe.
Yeah.
The miners did not, at any point that I found the Oregonian article, they never referred to them as being particularly large. They were just hairy men.
Hmm.
They looked like apes, and they said they looked like apes, but they didn't say that they were giant.
But this was this is the other thing that puzzles me about this, though, is that this was at nighttime, but they were able to see these big hairy guys, you know, way above them throwing rocks at them. I mean, I don't.
Yeah, how did they see it? I don't know. Was it a full moon So let's just jump ahead a little.
Yeah.
Or could it have been actually not really nighttime, but rather dusk?
Maybe that's it. Maybe it wasn't. Maybe it was evening, you know?
Yeah. I don't know how early to bed these miners were. Maybe they went to bed at like 6 o'clock.
Well, you know, and around here, it depends on the time of the year. I mean, it's June right now in Oregon. It's plenty light well after 9 p.m.
That's true. The sun didn't set today until around 10, so.
Yeah.
Didn't fully set.
So maybe that's what it was. You know, so it was late enough for them to be thinking about maybe it's time to go to bed, but there was still plenty of light outside.
Yeah.
Why
don't you tell us real quick about the Oregonian article that ran in 1983?
Oh, well, yeah, there was, they ran another article in 83 about this where they suddenly had come up with a possible explanation for it. Around that time, a camp counselor took some of his boys up to that ridge, he believed at least, sometime around sunset. And the story was told to somebody at the Oregonian years later.
I believe the person who told the Oregonian was a scout in that troop.
He was one of the scouts. Yeah, exactly.
I believe so, yes.
Yeah. The counselor just said, hey, kids, have fun. You know, you can like throw some of these big pumice boulders over the edge, you know, because you're, you know, and make yourself feel strong. And because we know what pumice is if you don't. If you spend any time in volcanic areas.
Yeah.
They are rocks that are, they look like rocks, but when you pick them up, they're about as heavy as styrofoam.
Yeah, they're really
light. Yeah, they are. They're volcanic rocks and mostly air. And you don't find them on this side of our mountains, but on just right on the other side of the mountains, there are lots
especially
of
especially Mount St. Helens. There's tons of it up on Mount St. Helens.
Yeah. And some volcanic areas here in Oregon as well. That just depends. So they were apparently having a good old time flinging pumice and other rocks over the cliff face. You know, and I recall doing similar silly stuff when I was a kid too.
I definitely remember at one point picking up a pumice boulder and feeling like Hercules.
I know.
Yeah, I'm invincible.
Yeah, now pumice is pretty cool.
It floats too. I don't know if you guys know that, but it'll float. You put it on water, it'll float. It's so cool to see a rock float.
I know. It's really cool. It's very novel. If you'd never seen it before or picked or handled it or anything, it's really cool. So these boys are just flinging all this stuff off of this cliff, you know, and you know, whooping and hollering and everything like that, and didn't realize that there were some guys down below who were getting pelted with their rocks. So anyway, this was, and then they were lucky that the miners, you know, didn't shoot them. Right. I guess they were high enough up and out of range that they couldn't be shot.
Yeah.
This cannot be confirmed. This is actually kind of speculative. I mean, this was one of the scouts later on who told this story to the paper.
Right. And the scout himself just believed, he thought that they might have been responsible for that story because he knew he was in the Ape Canyon area in 1924. There's a lot of details that don't totally line up, such as the miners said it was the middle of the night. But the boys, it was before a camp bedtime, and the sun was just setting, so it was probably not very late.
Yeah.
Anyway.
And so I don't know. It's the whole story from the miners. I mean, I don't know if they made it all up or if it really happened or somewhere in between. Maybe they ate some mushrooms. I mean, there's a lot of hallucinogenic mushrooms that grow up.
Yeah.
Just naturally out in the wild.
Yeah. We were talking earlier, there's a mold that grows on a lichen. The lichen itself is edible. I don't think it tastes very good, but if you were starving, it might be something you'd eat. But you got to watch out because it has a mold on it that will make you hallucinate, also make you terribly sick to your stomach. And there's a reason you don't know about lichen mold from the Mount St. Helens area as a recreational drug, because apparently it's something you never want to do. You believe you're dying and you see terrible things. It's apparently just awful.
Well, yeah, that is something you got to be careful about here. You know, I mean, there's basically three kinds of mushrooms out in the woods around here. There's the kind that you eat, they're nutritious and tasty and good for dinner. And then there's the kind that you eat and they get you high as a kite. And then there's the ones that kill you.
Yep.
And there's a lot of those too. So you gotta really know what you're doing. So the idea that these guys got themselves a bad crop of mushrooms or something, maybe that's what it is.
I really tried to see if anyone went up with a camera and took a picture of their wrecked cabin, but I've never seen any evidence.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, so this is a strange little story, and it's a mystery because what the hell happened here? You wouldn't think that some down-to-earth guys like a bunch of miners would actually, you know, make up something.
No, and from what I can tell, they didn't. The men were, at least according to the Argonian, known to be relatively reliable. They didn't, there was no question that they were maybe trying to like cash in insurance or make up for their inability to strike gold or whatever they're mining for up there. It doesn't seem like that. I'd actually more likely put it on either the Boy Scouts that story is true, or that maybe, and this is kind of dark, but maybe the Oregonian just made that up whole cloth to sell.
Because
it was a very popular story.
Such things are not unheard of. Even today they mix stuff up. But another possibility, I suppose, too, would be like some competing miners wanted to drive them off their claim. You know,
That's true.
And they built themselves a bunch of like catapults or something like that, some portable catapults they could truck up to the top of the mountain and fling big rocks on these guys. So maybe that was it. You know, I mean, there's all sorts of possibilities here.
Yeah, exactly.
But that's not the only mystery. But this is, by the way, how the canyon finally did get its name.
Ape Canyon. Yeah,
because of those deadly apes and their big rocks. So that was in what, 1924. There was a big discovery in 1947 of another thing that came to be called ape.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's this logger out here. We call them loggers. You don't call them lumberjacks or woodfellers. If you call them something else like that, they get mad at you. They're loggers. And this logger named Lawrence Johnson, he's looking to cut down some old growth when he nearly dies. He comes within inches of stepping into a man-sized hole and dropping to his death on jagged rocks about 17 feet below.
Mm.
Johnson's compatriots braced his legs for him and helped him to peer down into the hole with a flashlight. Might have been a lantern. And what he saw astonished him.
Yeah, I have personally been to this hole in the ground that he nearly stepped in.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. Many times. We're getting there, though.
Yeah, it's still there.
Oh, it's very much still there. There was not one, but two massive lava tubes down below.
Yeah.
Much, much larger than other ones in the area.
Yeah, this is the famous Ape Caves. And there's a little mystery surrounding those. First, let's give our listeners a description of this. We talked a little bit about it earlier, I think, but it's So the hole is right about this lava tube is 2.5 miles long, and the hole is about in the middle of it. So you can go down in there. They've actually built this metal stairway that goes down there today, so to make it easy to get into. Mm-hmm. The original cavers had to lower themselves down. They had to rappel down ropes in the hole. But so if you turn one direction, you go downhill. By the way, all lava tubes go downhill. No such thing as a perfectly level lava tube.
Nope.
Yeah, they had, because lava's flowing downhill. So so you go downhill, and that's the easy part of the cave. It goes down for quite a ways, and it sort of snakes around, and there's huge cavernous areas, and it's really cool. Mm-hmm. And pretty easy walking, because a lot of silty stuff has gotten in there over the eons and giving you mostly a fairly level, nice packed sand floor to walk on.
Yeah, it's a very easy hike, especially the short side.
Yeah, it's great. And so you stroll on down, but it dead ends. You got to turn and walk all the way back up to the entrance. If you go the other direction, though, you go to the upper part of the cave, and that's a lot rougher. There's a little more climbing involved. You got to climb over more breakdown and stuff like that. But it's cooler because, I mean, 90% of the people who visit Ape Cave go to the lower part because it's the easy part.
Yeah.
And so if you want to get away from humanity a little bit, then you do the upper part. You won't see, there's a good chance you can do that part of the cave and not see anybody. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And then, but that one doesn't dead end. That comes, it ends up in this little cavern, and there is a hole in the roof of the cavern where you can see sunlight streaming down through. And the Forest Service has very helpfully put in a little metal stairway so you can walk up out of that hole and find yourself in the middle of the forest.
It's actually really cool. Like emerging from this long, dark hike and then just coming out and you're just in the woods. It's beautiful up there.
Yeah, and there's a really beautiful trail that leads back to the parking lot. It's a nice hike. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a really, really... So you can turn around and go back down the cave if you want to, but the hike is pretty awesome. So
yeah, I think it's worth it to hike back on the surface and just kind of get a sense of like the difference, because you're walking the same length, right? The trail roughly follows the path of the cave. So when you walk back to the parking lot from climbing out of there, you're retracing your steps above ground. And it's kind of fun to be like, this is what it's like above ground. And I just was beneath ground.
Yeah, and then you can do it the reverse too. One time I went up there with a friend, and we hiked up the trail to the hole in the ground and went down and went down the other direction that people, you know, that you
that's go. Not that we need to get too far into the dynamics of this tourist attraction, but that's the way you're supposed to go now. That's how they want you to go.
Anyway, it's a cool cave. It's a very cool cave. If you do decide to do it, take 3 sources of light. Mm-hmm. Don't take just 1 flashlight. Not a good idea. Oh, wear a hard hat. Hard hat's good. Because when you bang your head in the cave, you really feel it. But anyway, so what do we got here? So Johnson and his crew didn't really have the equipment to explore this.
I don't think they're that interested. They had work to do.
Yeah, within a few years, though, a scout leader named Harry Reese came back. He had some spelunking experience.
Yeah, so Reese got the idea that he was a scout leader, and he would get the idea just to lower some of his boys down there. Because it was that time when you could just be like, here's an unexplored cave. Let's send a child in there. And what they found in there exceeded everyone's expectations. There were two massive lava tubes, tunnels is what they call them. And some of them rose to heights of over 60 feet from ceiling to floor. They're huge, like cathedral-like.
Yeah, I know. They are very, very cool. And they're not just round tunnels either. They had this weird wavy formation there's a sort of shelf that'll come out in the middle and then it'll round out and go back away again and then back up towards the ceiling. And kind of this really interesting shape to the tunnel.
They're really cool. Yeah, the shelves really stand out in my mind. It's really interesting how it's lined with these shelves. And
yeah.
You can shimmy up there and go walk around on some of the shelves. They're big enough to actually get up on.
Occasionally, in a few spots, Anyway, the original cavers would all go in and out on ropes. But eventually the Forest Service came in, because this is on Forest Service land. And they built this sort of structure that's basically kind of a metal scaffolding with staircases in it that takes you down there. So, and then they put in a parking lot so tourists could come in and get into and out of the cave pretty easily. So it's just a popular spot these days.
Oh, dude, we did that probably once or twice a year when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just something to do with your kids on it. Even if it's raining, you can do that, right?
Oh yeah, totally. And it's great in on a hot summer day because it's cool down there.
It's a constant, what, like 40 something degrees down there. So
40-50 degrees, something like that, on a freezing cold winter day. It's gonna be warmer down there than it is outside, you know. So yeah, it's an all year experience. As long as you can get to the parking lot. It might be tough in the winter, but
that's true. Yeah, you get to go that little road.
But there's one thing about the cave that's a little strange, though.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of a mystery there.
It's not what they found in the caves. It's what they didn't find.
Yeah.
From the time of Reese's Boy Scouts, they may have been the first humans to set foot in the cave. And this would be very strange. Because you can imagine, right, Joe, you can imagine the steep drop-off that would have made it difficult for Native Americans to access the site.
Mm-hmm.
But not impossible. They were known to camp and store things in lava tubes all across the Mount St. Helens area.
Oh, yeah.
And Ape Cave would have made a great place for that.
Yeah, and there's actually a way, there's one cave, I'll talk about it later, that one of the ways to get into it was climbing down a tree.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody had basically cut off a tree and then cut the limbs off, but cut them off, say, maybe a foot from the trunk.
Right.
And then drop the whole thing in there, and then you could use the tree as a ladder and just climb right down it. And the Indians certainly would have been smart enough to figure that out and do that.
We know they had ladder building technology. They actually were pretty good at creating rope.
Yeah.
I don't know that a 17-foot drop would have just dead stopped them from even trying to go in there.
Yeah, I don't know. It might have just been far enough out of their way. Maybe there just wasn't enough good game and stuff like that up there that far up the mountain. Maybe that was why they weren't interested in it.
But that's the thing about Ape Cave as opposed to Ape Canyon. It's not that far up the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know why they didn't go in there. Clearly, there must have been a reason.
Yeah.
But what we do need to talk about is that a rumor started.
Mm-hmm.
The rumor goes like this, Joe.
Yeah.
The natives, they always knew about the place. And this is probably true. They had a pretty encyclopedic knowledge of that mountain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But they were smart enough never to venture inside because they knew that those caves were home to what, since the 1930s, has become known as Sasquatch.
Ooh, yeah, could be.
And really, if you go there, one does not need an overactive imagination to picture these caves populated with ape men and their mates and their babies.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it really does. You know, you really can see it as like a massive, dark, dank troglodyte domain, inaccessible to mortal man. Like it has that kind of weight to it when you're down there.
Yeah, no, you could definitely house a pretty big Bigfoot population down inside there.
Yeah.
Yeah, you really could. We'd never found any evidence that Bigfoot or any other ape-like men ever lived down in that cave. There just isn't anything. You would think that there'd be evidence of, like, say, fires and bones left over from game, things like that. That's typically stuff you find in caves.
There is evidence of animals having gone down there, but not anything that would lead us to believe that any kind of ape man tribe, Tiako ape man, ever lived down there.
Yeah, I don't know. It could be that maybe that was a Bigfoot habitat at one time or another. I don't know. Or it could be just a spooky story somebody made up. It might have been the Indians found it and they poked their heads in there and scoped it out and just finally decided, you know, it's kind of a hassle to get in and out of it.
Yeah,
and there's just nothing down there. There's nothing living there that we can kill and eat. And it's just a hassle to get in and out. So screw it. Well, you know, we're going to move on.
Yeah.
Because maybe that's all that happened.
Yeah. I just don't see any of that as a good enough reason to ruin, you know, someone's dad's awesome spooky story while he takes his kids through a local tourist attraction inside the cavern.
It could have been, you know, maybe they're gone now or just in hiding, but it could have been something living down there, kind of like from that movie, The Descent.
Ooh, yeah. You know? I think about that every time I go in there.
Yeah, whenever you go caving, you got to think about that movie. Ooh.
So you
those
have
are some scary little critters.
You have a story about a lava tube really nearby Ape Caves, right?
There are actually several pretty awesome lava tubes right in that immediate area. And there's one really close by called Little Red River Cave. And I know you said you've heard of it, right? I don't think you've been through it.
I haven't been through it. Well, it's locked up.
It's a gated cave.
Yeah. So you got to have special permission to get in there. But I'm pretty sure I went right by it last time I was up at Ape Caves.
Yeah.
I couldn't get in because it was locked.
Yeah, it's a little tougher to get to. There is no parking lot. There's no signs. There's no well-defined trail leading to it. But if you know the right people who know where it's at, they can show you where it's at. And if you can get a key, you can go into it. And I was, this is probably, this is actually a little over 20 years ago. I went through there with three friends. So there were four of us in the party. And we managed to procure a key in a kind of, what's the word I'm thinking about? Yeah, it's not slight, not entirely legal how we did it, but we managed to get a key.
And I was curious how that was going to play out.
Yeah, we did. Yeah, it was not entirely legal, but we did no harm. We had no intent to hurt anybody or do any damage to the cave. We just wanted to go through the cave. We wanted to do a little caving. So this one goes, you go down in this depression in the ground, and there's a hole there where the cave entrance is, and there's where the gate is. Mm-hmm. And it's a friggin' stout steel gate. And then there's two locks, one on the outside, one on the inside. So, and then once you get inside, if you turn right and walk smartly to the right, you'll drop off this cliff and fall to your death. So it's recommended that you turn left instead. That takes you through a tunnel that leads into this room. And you climb down off this shelf to the lower part of the room and then turn right and head down that way. And there's a fissure at the wall at the end of the room. And below that is another room. That is the room that you would have followed to if you'd gone to the right when you walked through the cave. So anyway, so that leads. And then that was where I saw the tree that had been converted into a ladder. Somebody had put a tree in that fissure so you could climb down the tree to get to that lower room. But then the tree eventually rotted away. And so now the best way to get down there is to just take ropes and climbing harnesses and stuff, and lower yourself down and then climb back out at the end of your adventure. And that's the only part of the cave where you need to do anything fancy rope wise or anything like that. We did this whole thing. It's about 3/4 of a mile long. It's fairly rough. A good amount of climbing is involved and such. And there's a lot of breakdown and stuff in there. And when you get, it's called Little Red River Cave because as you get down towards the bottom of it, you get below the water table and water starts coming in through little fissures in the walls. So you get rivulets of water running down the walls and onto the floor. And these little channels have eroded into the floor of the cave. So there's these little streams of water under your feet, and there's this oxide in the soil that made the lava kind of reddish. So the walls are kind of reddish and there's all this water running, and you keep going. You got to bend over and sort of walk doubled over for a little part of it too, with all this water tinkling around you and stuff. So it's kind of interesting. It's kind of a weird claustrophobic feeling to be in the middle of all this water and stuff. And then you get to the bottom, which is a lake. It ends, the whole thing fills up with water and you can't go any further unless you brought some scuba gear with you. So the lake at the bottom, you stop there with your friends, you check it out for a little bit. Then you turn around, of course, and go back. As we're heading back, we're a ways away from the lake. And I'm not sure how far, at least 200 or 300 yards. And I was in the back, I was bringing up the rear, and I heard this sound behind me. And there was nobody else down there. There could not have been. Absolutely no way. But I heard this sound. It sounded like a soft thud coming from deep behind me in the cave. Now, that was a little creepy. I got to tell you. It was a little creepy. I was wondering, and I didn't panic or anything like that. I wasn't terrified, but I was just like, I stopped and I looked around and I said to my friends, did you guys hear that? And they were like, no. So we just held still to see if we heard it again, and we didn't. So I had no idea what made that sound. I still had no idea. And we didn't die or anything like that. It was fine, but it was.
Oh, really?
Was
you are still? Are you sure you're still alive?
Well, that's a good point. Yeah, I don't know. But anyway, no, it wasn't something to panic over. But it was. I still have no idea what could have made that noise.
Huh.
I mean.
Yeah, what would have been back there?
I mean, yeah, I don't know.
Huh.
And I'm pretty sure there's nothing living in that lake because. There's nothing to eat down there for one thing. I mean,
what do you think the odds are that maybe we have ape caves all wrong and the apes live in Little Red River Cave?
Yeah, it could be. And they just go down submerged in the lake and hold their breath until the people, get bored and leave, and then they come back up. And maybe that's what it was.
Maybe.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, so it is a mystery.
That is creepy. It's a creepy story.
Yeah, it is a little creepy, but that's my own personal mystery. That's about the only really creepy thing that's happened to me up there. I've been up there quite a lot, as obviously you have too. It's a nice area.
I have actually quite a bit, and I honestly don't have any good scary stories to tell from up there. If I could take the podcast up. Like I said, my father was a logger and he used to repeat stories to me that his fellow loggers experienced up there. But I'm not going to, maybe one day I'll go into those, but.
Well, we'll do another episode on that. But there was a really creepy story that happened back in the 50s.
Yeah. Right in 1950.
Yeah. So you're the expert on this story. Tell us all about it.
So this is honestly what I really wanted to write about. I wanted to give you the context of this kind of mysterious and beautiful place.
Yeah, now we're getting to the true mysterious, scary story that happened up in Abe Canyon after all of our meanderings here.
So there's a 32-year-old man. His name is Jim Carter, not Jimmy Carter, just like Davy Crockett is not Dave Crockett.
Yeah.
And for that matter, Harry Truman is not Harry S. Truman the present. There was a 20-person climbing party from Seattle. It's May of 1950. Perfect time to climb the mountain. Mm-hmm. And remember, the mountain wouldn't have looked like it looks now. It would have had a big haystack dome over it, not a caldera.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the climb was actually successful. It went really smoothly. On the descent, he left the other climbers near a landmark. It's known as Dog's Head. I've been up around Dog's Head. It's about 8,000 feet, so it's really high.
Yeah, it's popular. That is a popular stopping off point on for ascents and descents from the mountain.
Yeah, so now you go up Dog's Head if you want to see the rim of the caldera.
Yeah, I mean, Dog's Head used to be called a false summit because you could actually, if you're coming up from one side, you could actually believe that you're getting close to the top of the mountain. Then you get up to the top of Dog's Head and you realize, oh, crap, this is just a bump on the side of the mountain. And I got a couple of thousand more feet to go. But it used to be a false summit. Now it is a summit.
It pretty much is. Yeah,
it is. Yes.
Yeah, it is. That's the highest point left.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So when I've hiked the rim, we've taken the Dog's Head trail up. So I know this area pretty well.
No, yeah.
Not really, but I've been there.
But this is where Jim Carter parted ways with his companions, never to be seen again.
Never. So Carter was by far the most experienced skier and mountaineer in the group. And he told the other climbers that what he was going to do was ski down ahead of them so he could take a picture of the group as they skied down to the timberline, put up on their Instagrams or whatever they did in 1950.
Back in 1950, they had this this sort of brass and wood steam-powered Instagram. Right? Yeah.
So after he left, the group sighted him skiing wildly and unsafely. He was moving really fast. And he was taking chances that no skier would take unless something was really, really wrong. Or maybe if he was being pursued.
Mm-hmm.
Carter literally jumped over two large ice crevasses, right? So that's like a really steep canyon in a glacier. This is dangerous. The ice around, the ice and the snow around the edges of these things are not stable. So doing jumps near them is not something you would ordinarily want to do.
Asking for trouble. Hell yes, you are.
Yeah. And there was no indication that he had any reason to act like this. This is the kind of thing someone would do if they're trying to ski ahead of an avalanche. But nothing like that was happening. They did see him looking over his shoulder like he was frightened of something. The men couldn't see what that would possibly be. Eventually, Carter was lost from view. He, from the perspective of the men who were still coming down the mountain on the other side of Dog's Head, the rock that is Dog's Head blocked them from seeing him. When these other climbers, this party of 20, reached the spot where Carter was supposed to rendezvous with them, he was nowhere to be found.
Mm-hmm.
So the climbers searched as long as they could, but they couldn't even find tracks for him.
Not even ski tracks, right?
No, nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they did a big search for this guy. They searched for weeks, I believe, this whole area, and they never found a trace of him.
Well, they found one tiny little trace of him.
Yeah.
It was a discarded film box near Dog's Head. So right up, not super far from where he separated from the group.
Yeah. So that wasn't a terribly useful clue, but they did actually find some ski tracks though. Some of it, which they, which were probably his.
Yeah, they think so. They went straight down this really steep side of Ape Canyon. They basically just shot down the canyon walls.
And now by the time you get in Ape Canyon at this point, you're in the tree line, right?
No. So this would still be well above the tree line. This would be, you'd be within, I don't know the exact distance, but I'd say you're probably within a mile of what's called this volcanic ash field, historic ash field, so called Plains of Abraham.
Way further up Ape Canyon than where Ape Cave is and all that
Further up. You'd be looking at this area from Ape Cave, but you're way higher up. You're getting pretty close to where the caldera is now.
Mm-hmm.
So you're pretty high up.
The question is, as he goes down the side of Ape Canyon, that is a really dangerous thing to do, even for an experienced skier like Carter, right?
Well, not only is it a dangerous thing to do, but even if he'd been like, I'm just going to shred some snow today, he didn't tell anyone he was going to do that. Mm-hmm. And it would put him, after having done it, miles from his group.
Yeah.
So it's odd. Carter was not, that I can tell, was not known to do things like this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that's the thing about it is like, as far as I know from I'm not an expert in the geography of the area, but once he skis down into the canyon, then he goes down the canyon until he gets to the tree line. And beyond that, I don't know if he can ski anymore, if he's got to stop and walk, or if he's got to hike back up the side of the canyon, or, you know, it's just, it wouldn't be convenient to get back out of the canyon.
It doesn't make a lot of sense. He'd be alone, and we'll get to it in a second. But also, one thing anyone who does even a little bit of skiing knows is you don't want to ski into the tree line.
And so obviously
it's really dangerous.
No, yeah, it is. You start skiing into the trees and you're going to do a Sonny Bono, you know,
that's exactly. Exactly.
There were theories that were proposed at the time, because obviously this was a legit mystery. What the hell happened to Jim Carter? They never found a trace of him. They didn't find his body, his skis,
anything.
They didn't find anything. Yeah. He just vanished. There was a popular theory though, right?
There was a theory kind of caught hold among people who were regulars up on Mount St. Helens. It basically goes like this. Carter separates from the group. He sees Sasquatch. It's up there walking around beyond the tree line where he really likes to hang out. And he stops. He tries to grab a picture of it, but Carter is detected.
Yeah. And by the way, the Sasquatch hates the damn paparazzi.
Does not like and have his picture taken. Everybody knows that. So the beast attempts to pursue him, but Carter thinks maybe he has an advantage. He's attempting to flee on skis. He thinks he might be able to outrun it, especially if he cuts down the steep canyon walls, which would be risky for a qualified skier, but maybe he could get down there, and that certainly would be faster than any man or animal on foot.
Mm-hmm.
So it could have been a calculated risk.
Totally outrun the Mr. Sasquatch doing that.
Right. So anyway, that's the story I've heard. I've seen it even reprinted almost word for word from the way I learned it on the internet. So other people have heard this story. Whatever the case may be, searchers, they did expect to find Jim Carter deceased and smashed up at the bottom of this canyon.
Like, yeah, wrapped around a bottom, wrapped around a tree, maybe.
Or a boulder. I think they were thinking he would have not even made it there, that he would have tried to go down this wall, lost his footing, rolled, and they'd find him down there. But they didn't.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He just wasn't there. But here's the weird, this is where it starts to get really strange. A searcher in an airplane found ski tracks that were leading toward the Eagle Creek Ranger Station before they disappeared into dense wilderness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, these tracks likely could have been Carter's, but the mystery is, how did he get from his last known position just beyond Dog's Head to the tracks that led into the woods without leaving any tracks connecting the two sets? Did he like levitate?
Yeah, unless it was some other skier, or maybe some wind came up and blasted away part of his ski tracks in one place, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, so my understanding is it wouldn't have been a common place to ski, so they kind of attributed it to him since they didn't know of anyone else who was skiing in that area. But then how did he get from his last sighted tracks on that steep canyon wall?
Skiers are notoriously lazy. They don't go up the mountain unless they have what's called a ski lift to take them up the side of the mountain. Yeah. And this place did not have a ski lift.
No.
Yeah.
No. So. Yeah, exactly. So it's really hard to figure out. I think it is actually really like, it kind of tells a good story, right? Mm-hmm. Carter, for some reason, no one knows why, got in his head that he wanted to go down this crazy steep terrain, often in the middle of nowhere. No one knows why he would do that.
Yeah.
Especially without telling anybody.
Yeah.
And that somehow he actually lives through this and then ends up in the woods all smashed up under a tree. And then somehow between animal predation and whatever, we just managed to never find his body.
Yeah.
But the gap between the tracks, this is so we're clear, Joe, this is miles of gap.
Well, and the irrational behavior, I'm not so sure about him seeing Sasquatch or whatever, but this is kind of almost Dyatlov Passy in sort of a way. You know, it's like somebody, a super experienced mountaineer and climber and everything, all of a sudden just sort of loses it and does some weird, inexplicable stuff, you know, and we don't know why.
It's even weirder than Dyatlov Pass, because there was no emergency. Everything I can find says it was a nice sunny day.
Yeah.
The climb had gone better than expected. They were having fun on the descent. That's why Carter was trying to snap pictures.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like they got hit by a freak snowstorm and Carter made a stupid decision to go flying off in some random direction in the hopes that he could get help or anything like that. It's far less explicable than that. He just flew off, said, I'll see you guys in a few minutes, took off his own way, and then disappeared into thin air. And nothing about Carter that I've ever been able to uncover says that that would have tracked anything with his personality. Mm. I mean, he taught skiing and mountain safety.
Yeah.
He would know better than to go off without telling his group who were depending on him.
Yeah. So, yeah.
It's pretty weird.
Yeah. And after all these many years, it's been 70 years now, 70 mm-hmm. plus years, they'd never found a shred of evidence, not a bit.
Nothing.
But then and then the people that were out there searching for Carter said that they were kind of creeped out mm-hmm. by the area. Felt like they were being watched.
That's a frequent thing. Is that there's actually a couple of guys who were alive back then who, at least as of a few years ago, were alive for an anniversary and talked about it. They said that especially whenever they got to be alone during the search, they felt like someone had eyes on them.
Uh-huh. Hmm.
So some people say Sasquatch might have been behind this appearance.
Well, Sasquatch or something else. You know, there could be other things living up there. You know?
Who knows? Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Or other people, too. There could be some, you know, Unabomber serial killer kind of guy living up there.
He would have been way up there if he was messing with Jim Carter, but maybe.
Yeah, okay, but well, and even if there is a Unabomber guy, that doesn't explain Carter's behavior.
It doesn't become exactly. Yeah. It's actually kind of why I like it. So I do want to point in, a lot of you out there have probably played Ski Free. Mm. It's a game that used to come with Windows computers. It's kind of remembered ironically. It wasn't a particularly interesting game, but some of us spent hours as kids playing it. And, you know, if you go past the end zone, the finish line, I guess you'd say, you get chased down and eaten by a Yeti. And a lot of people feel that that game was designed in Seattle. A lot of people feel that it's a Jim Carter reference.
Hmm, could be.
So there you go. Okay. Part of my childhood.
I never played Ski Free, but, you know.
Oh, you're missing out, man.
I know. Damn it. I guess I need to do that. Hey, but let's see, what else? What other mysteries have we got here? I mean, I guess it's just some miscellaneous stuff. I mean,
just a few miscellaneous stuff. Let's talk about how weird this area is.
Yeah, it is. It's apparently some loggers have reported seeing ape men.
Many, many
and tracks left by the ape men out there, and in like the 1950s and on. And apparently, they've taken plaster casts of these big footprints left behind by the ape, which leads, of course, to the popular term Bigfoot. I don't know exactly when it began to be used instead of Sasquatch.
You will see Bigfoot start being used, usually, in my experience, and this is just my anecdotal experience, in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
The word Bigfoot does not come up even once when you read contemporaneous reports of the 1924 Bigfoot incident.
Yeah, the 60s were kind of a lively time for all sorts of stuff like this. Things really started entering that sort of the popular consciousness.
It's really around, probably I'd say the late 60s that you start seeing like little roadside museums that have the plaster casts.
Yeah.
It's that time that you start hearing Bigfoot described, one, as being particularly large, and then also having really large feet that leave these mm-hmm. perfectly flat footprints.
Beyond that, let's see, also Kenneth Arnold, I believe, sighted the very first flying saucer in that area.
Yeah, that would have been 1947. Yeah.
And he was a military pilot, correct?
No, he was a civilian pilot. He was looking for a downed military plane.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. So he was part of a search and rescue effort. Yeah.
That's right. He was. Yeah. He was. And he was actually like not super close. He was crossing vaguely close to Mount St. Helens on his way to Mount Rainier.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not super close, but a lot of people associate it with the town of Ariel. And that's basically at the base of Ape Canyon.
Yeah. And Ariel, of course, is associated with our old buddy D.B. Cooper.
That's right.
Some people, it's not exactly clear where he landed, because it all depends. He bailed out quite a ways, like 10 miles at least further south of this area. But it all depends. I mean, the prevailing winds were blowing the northeast. So if he opened his parachute right after he bailed, then he probably would have landed right about at the base of Ape Canyon or somewhere fairly close by. Yeah. It all depends on when he opened his parachute. We don't know.
Exactly. I think it's worth saying that if you just take an outer space view, D.B. Cooper didn't land super far from where all the stuff we're talking about.
No, not really.
It's not right next door. He didn't necessarily, I don't think anyone seriously believes he landed like in Ape Canyon. Mm-hmm. I hear a lot of like Cougar Merwin areas where they think he came down.
Yeah.
And then there's debate over that. But the point is, he's in that vicinity.
Yeah, no, it's believed by many that he came down somewhere in the Lewis River watershed.
Yeah.
Which is what Ape, you know, basically that's right at the mouth of Ape Canyon.
Mm-hmm.
So, but who knows? I mean, I'm not even 100% sure that he bailed out where the FBI says he bailed out.
That's true. But there's a lot of debate about it. I'm just saying, D.B. Cooper's up in this mix.
D.B. Cooper is part of it. When, of course, the Mima Mounds, or Mima Mounds, depending on, you know, your point of view. They're not that far away from here either.
No, they're like a couple hours from there. So they're not super close, but it's the same part of the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we talked about that in the old podcast on
Thinking
Good episode. Sideways.
Really love that episode.
I'm glad you liked that episode.
I loved it.
Yeah, it's still kind of a little puzzle there. What the hell are these mounds?
Yeah.
All these hundreds of mounds doing there. Who the hell built them? Who did this? And there's some weird stuff going on up there. Mm-hmm. Aside from my little experience in Little Red River Cave, I've never experienced too much of the way of weirdness.
Nah, me neither. So, but it is, I think it is a mysterious case. And the last thing I want to add, in case you're wondering, this area was actually largely spared from the eruption in 1980.
Yeah, it got a little bit of ash fall, I think, at least it got
a lot of ash fall. It also, there was this is actually really funny. They call it the Lahar Mud Flow.
Yeah.
Lahar is Spanish for the mud flow. So it's the mud flow. Yeah,
the mud flow, mud flow. I like
the mud flow, mud flow raced down through there and did quite a bit of damage, but it totally spared Ape Cave.
Mm-hmm.
And aside from depositing tons of rock and silt in some kind of random areas and knocking over some trees, this area was actually totally preserved.
Yeah, thinking about it, silty, rich soil being flooding into your air is not necessarily a bad thing for your forest.
you can see the sort of tailings or whatever that the floods left behind. But now they're rich with small trees and tons of shrubs and wildlife and stuff. So it's really come back. It feels great up there. It doesn't feel like it's still recovering from a massive volcanic eruption.
No, not really. It's a great place. Don't let the volcano scare you away. It's actually it's pretty quiescent these days.
It's pretty nice. Give us a little scare.
Nobody's too worried about it. Basically, it did its thing. It's going to rebuild itself for thousands of years and then do it again, but we'll be gone by then. So don't worry about it.
At the very least, even if that's not true, you absolutely are safe to go up and visit Ape Canyon and especially the Ape Caves.
Oh, sure.
So if you're in the area, you really should.
Absolutely. Yeah. If you're in town, if you're in the area, you're planning on going up there, give us a call. Maybe we'll go with you. I got a couple of hard hats laying around somewhere still. Lots of flashlights. Yeah, that's about it. The mysteries of Ape Canyon.
That's it. It's a crazy place.
Okay. Well, I guess that's about it for this week. Please stay tuned for some important information from our buddy Tess about our email and all that good stuff. And of course, as always, our usual plea for you to leave us a rating and a review. We like that.
It helps people find the show, and that means a lot.
It's good, yeah. Well, I guess we'll see you guys next week.
Bye.
The Shocking Details can be found at www.theshockingdetails.com. We're on Twitter at Shocking Details. For discussion of episodes and more, our Facebook group is facebook.com/groups/shockingdetailspodcast/. Or you can email us at theshockingdetailspodcast@gmail.com. And if you like the podcast, please consider giving us a like and a positive review and letting people know about us.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.